internet recruitment can be hit or miss. You can get really squared away dudes right off the rip, and they do other impressions, or they do World War One or whatever, and they kind of know the, they just want the guidelines and they can figure it out. And then you have the, you know, the Indonesian 14-year-olds that are talking about crazy stuff on the internet.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Reenactors Corner podcast. This is Chris here again with a special guest, Marcus. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Happy to be here.
Excellent. So why don't you tell our listeners how you got interested in World War II, how you got interested in reenacting, and what you're up to in reenacting now?
Sure. So as you already alluded to, my name's Marcus. Started off reenacting very similarly, as I imagine, to most people of my time through the History Channel back when it had decent programming. I actually didn't know World War II reenacting in the States was a thing, so I saw some color footage of what looked like actors doing a normal, you know, Band of Brothers television type thing on, I think it was a D-Day, the Forgotten Tapes or the Forgotten History or something. And then there was some credits rolling, and there was some websites for some reenactment units in the Mid-Atlantic region of the U.S. So I started the internet search, and here we are. So since then, I've reenacted with a few different organizations, most notably being 3PGD in the New England states, 195 Your Old Group in New England as well. And then when I moved to Europe, I was with a... with Panzerjäger Abteilung 228 in Germany. And then now that I'm back in America, but living more southern, I've chosen to start my own group, which is Grenadier Regiment 41.
Cool. So you had been a reenactor for a long time before you moved to Europe for a time. What was that like, kind of trying to get into the reenactment scene in Europe from the perspective of being an American reenactor?
So... It was very challenging and very interesting. So obviously the first challenge that comes up for most people, most Americans specifically, is the language barrier. So even though I can speak German fairly okay, especially for someone from the States, when you're speaking to people at normal conversational speed and with regional diction, it can get confusing. So there was of course the language barrier, but then there's also a very, very big difference in the styles of reenacting, and I found that to be the most not off-putting, but the most different for sure.
Yeah, what was different about it? How would you characterize the European style from your perspective?
That's a good question. I would say that it's a stark contrast to the American perspective, at least in my experience. So the European reenacting style, I think, is much more experiential. I didn't see that they focus so much on material culture as American reenactors do, because it is kind of their material culture. So they focus much more on the, at least my group, the simulation aspect of trying to figure out what a military in the Third Reich may have operated at, and also experiential, meaning like scale is real. So the field kitchen formations, you know, your squad leader might not like what you have on, communal, you know, laying field foams at 2 o'clock in the morning, overnight watch, things like that. Like, it was much more regimented and felt much more military in nature, whereas the on our side of the Atlantic now, the U.S., things are much more material culture based and a little bit more democratic than a military organization would be. So you have kind of two different sides of the coin in one hobby, which I found very, very interesting and also very, very different.
That is interesting. You moved back to the United States, and you could have maybe joined an existing organization, but kind of decided instead to have a go at doing your own thing. Why did you decide to do it that way?
Well, I guess the main reason is, So I lived in Germany for quite some time, a little over six years. So, and also through those 6 years, the United States had shifted significantly, especially reenacting with the COVID pandemic and all the different geopolitical changes that have happened in the country. So honestly, I was a little bit disconnected in the American reenactment community. I didn't really know the personalities or the units that really existed, because to be honest, a lot of the websites that exist are dead links, or Facebook groups that haven't been updated in two years or whatever. It's a little bit of a nightmare on the data management side. And also, I don't want to venture out and say try something new, but I kind of wanted to try a fusion between the two ways. Like, you know, some obviously material culture is important, especially for an American, because German culture is not your natural native culture for most of us. And then also try a little bit more on the simulation side. So not necessarily a fresh or new or different thing, just the way that I thought it would be best to try out.
And so you decided to do Grenadier Regiment 41. What was it about that unit that made you want to portray that particular group?
So where I was living at in Germany is in a place, a county in Bavaria called the Oberpfalz. And in the Oberpfalz, there's it's basically Weiden in der Oberpfalz is the central, I guess you could call it it's the region where that unit, especially that 3rd Battalion of that regiment came from. So it was very easy for me to do primary source researching for where their barracks were, where they initially came from before the regional recruitment and organization was disbanded somewhere in late 1942, I think. I know where their division headquarters was in Regensburg. I know where their barracks were. I know where their sister battalion was from Amberg. So that's about a 45-minute drive. Like, it was just very easy for me to see my face in the place and also understand the culture of the locals and just, you know, the kind of get a little bit deeper into the zeitgeist, I guess you could say, because the Oberpfalz, if anybody's familiar with Germany, is a very, very, very old place, and it's a little bit like the South Alabama of America. So people haven't changed so much where it's unrecognizable.
That sounds really cool. You mentioned the cultural aspect, and you and I have talked about this before. What are some ways that you are trying to incorporate German cultural elements into Wehrmacht reenacting?
So for me, as the unit coordinator of this newish project, I am acting as the squad leader. So a lot of times I kind of use my character as the squad leader to almost be a disciplinarian of cultural norms for something that would be considered normal for the Wehrmacht or for a German person in the 40s. So, you know, when you're in line to get your soup out of the Essenträger, you're not eating until everybody else has been served and everyone is washed up before dinner. Things of that nature, you know what I mean? And also with my group being of such diverse, coming from such diverse people, I don't really know what their cultural background is or what their cultural understanding is of Germany or of the Bavarian countryside. So I like to, as often as possible, incorporate things that would have been normal for those people. So we will have Leberwurstbrot for breakfast, or just a Butterbrot for breakfast, or any of the recipes that come out of the Essenträger. Those are always World War II German or World War II, or excuse me, not World War II specifically, but they're always very cultural dishes. Erbsensuppe, pea soup with ham is a big one for us. That was something that was mentioned specifically from one of the veterans I got to talk to over there. He said pea soup or soup with peas every day is like a normal thing for him. So just incorporating some of the cultural mannerisms and also the food is a big part of what we do.
I know that you had written in the past about a focus on communal activities, and I know that food is part of that. How do you guys deal with the food aspect at events specifically?
So it's a little bit different. It's not different, I guess. We had to, of course, there are no field kitchens, right? There is no government supporting us with what we need to fight every day. So the way that we managed to do that, it's kind of an approach that I haven't seen too often. So we basically recon whenever we go to a field exercise or a field event. We basically recon an alternate site, which is the what you would call like the Essenausgabe. So we would pitch that kind of in the woods. It's usually just a poncho or some sort of a tent system, and underneath there is a cooler, usually a pretty decent cooler that we store frozen food in, and then all of our fresh provisions. So twice a day, we'll send runners back to that that Essenausgabe, and they will retrieve either the soup or the dry rations or whatever in the big burlap bags or the food backpack or whatever we have to use.
That's a clever idea. You mentioned some of the hot food that you guys eat, but I've seen in pictures also the cold rations that you guys have, where you have repackaged edible modern foodstuffs in correct type, maybe commercial or in some cases military packaging of the era. Are you making all that stuff yourself?
Yes, for the most part, for kind of again to foster the communal aspects of military service, and also to kind of foster more of a group environment, like through shared hardships. I do repackage and make all of our food stuff. So anything from lacquering cans of meat to making the later war, like supplementary rations for frontline soldiers, things like that. I will do that for everybody that comes to the event. So we'll have exactly the same thing. We will get it at the same time. It's actually interesting that sometimes through, I guess, kind of a forcing function, the non-smokers will trade their sweets away to a smoker, or vice versa. There'll be something that's like the hot ticket item in one of these little rations things. And I find that kind of very interesting, and also kind of like, it's very validating, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's cool. It is a thing that you can read about or in memoirs or hear about in veteran interviews. So it is cool to be able to sort of incorporate that kind of thing into a reenactment event.
It's interesting when, like certain things take on their own economy. Do you know what I mean? Like something you can put in your hand, something you can use.
Sure. Now, regular listeners of the podcast have heard me talk to Casey before. He has been sort of a frequent repeat guest, and I know he is in your group. He's talked before about aspects of weapons, machine guns, his skill as an armorer in the Marines, and how that kind of crosses over. And that's something that I notice in your group, looking at the pictures. You guys have the correct sort of what a squad would be outfitted with, which is something that I know a lot of groups struggle with. How important was it for you to be able to replicate that sort of by the book approach, the way that it was supposed to be for an infantry unit?
So for me, that was the starting point, right? So when you, at least to me, right, there's always a doctrinal basis for everything, and everything kind of like the doctrinal base is what norm should be. Now, the photographic record might not reflect that due to shortages or due to abnormalities in the supply lines or whatever, but the doctrinal standard exists, and it existed throughout most of the conflict. So really that was our starting point with the HDV 130-2A. That's like the Vorschrift für Schutz und Company, I think. So we started there. And that outlines everything very, very, very specifically and easily. It leaves a little bit of questions, of course, because some, you know, the scale of issue for soldiers isn't exactly laid out, right? It just has what their additional duty, like their additional duty equipment is. And it also does it does outline some abnormalities, like the infantry squad leader always wearing wire cutters, where that the photographic record doesn't seem to be the case. So that it was very important to us to start from norm and then exist in that norm to kind of be a, not necessarily a counterfoil, but kind of just, this is what it's supposed to look like, and then everything other than that is non-standard, I guess you could say. So it's easy to, if you fall short on one or two things, like, that is okay, because 95% of you is going to be doctrinally correct.
That's a real challenge, I think, for a lot of reenactment groups, in that the equipment needed to present this sort of complete unit impression is scarce or difficult to obtain. It can be very expensive. how long have you been kind of working on gathering all of these accessories and pieces of equipment that are needed to portray a unit of that scale?
So I think for the infantry squad specifically, it's not too taxing. I mean, it's taxing to a regular civilian, of course, or a regular person, but I don't think it's too taxing for a reenactment group to handle. A lot of these things can be traded out one for one, and the reproductions do exist. Like, of course, machine guns are inherently expensive, but that kind of is par for the course. So if you wanted to do this impression or just simply go by the norm, it's not that much more expensive than regular field gear. Like if you do have access to a cruiser machine gun, I mean, I think off the top of my head, it requires a cruiser machine gun, a machine pistol, which is mostly, if you're going to do that impression, you have that anyway. And then it's, four or five ammo cans and two ammo can straps with the associated blank firing pistols to go with the machine gun crew. So it's not terribly, overly taxing. There are some things that we have that make things a little easier, but we could also do without. It's just, I guess, nice for pictures. Like the food thermos backpack, there are ways around that. You could send a guy to your SNLSKABE with just 8 mess kits, and that would be no less realistic. There are ways around everything. It's just really, you're limited by your own creativity, I guess. But for me personally, I've been collecting these things, mostly because I'm a sick hoarder, but I've been collecting these things for, I mean, as long as I've been in Europe, because the things are just much, much more available there.
When you were getting started with your new project, you, of course, had to create guidelines for what members were to wear. You had to set kit standards and expectations for authenticity in that department. What was your approach to that part of it?
So my approach to that part of it was, there was twofold. There was one, which was looking at the existing photographic record of Infantry Regiment 41, or Grenadier Regiment 41, excuse me. And so that is a little bit incomplete, because other than a photo of some, or a couple photos of some guys that had earned the Knight's Cross in 1945, the photographic record to me seems to break off around 1941 is when I can no longer find pictures of them in combat. So to me, I guess from a practical reenactment standpoint, what I wanted to do was be able to have the most flexible kit that's the most normal, I guess, that can show either a hyper late war vignette or a kind of bog standard here infantry vignette. So for that, we chose the M40 tunic with standard generic insignia. And then for an option B, I guess you could call it, is whatever every member has to own to be a complete member. It would be that normal uniform that they already own, plus a Sumpftarn hooded smock and an M43 cap to really pull off the late war look.
That's cool. What about, once you had sort of the framework of the unit, you knew what you were going to be portraying, you knew what you wanted people to wear, you knew what your approach was going to be. Then I guess the next step is recruiting members, right? How has that been working out for you?
So it's been interesting, to say the least. For the most part, it's actually been kind of refreshingly easy because of the network of people that I know from reenacting, not necessarily units, but individuals. And a lot of them were mid-Atlantic and South. So, it was pretty nice to retouch with them and see kind of who's what and what's still on. The downside is that, as I suspected, a lot of either COVID or new geopolitical things or new times have shifted. So a lot of the old reenactment units that I knew and loved kind of don't exist anymore or exist in name only. So a lot of the guys that I had contacted when I came back from Germany were like, man, I'm glad you reached out. I think I would have been done reenacting if it weren't for you. So the first part was easy. Of course, as you well know with your group, internet recruitment can be hit or miss. You can get really squared away dudes right off the rip, and they do other impressions, or they do World War One or whatever, and they kind of know they just want the guidelines and they can figure it out. And then you have the Indonesian 14-year-olds that are talking about crazy stuff on the internet. So it's kind of a filter, you know?
Yeah, if only there was some way we could utilize all those 14-year-old Indonesians, we could have massive scale events. Yeah, I mean, we could have perhaps the Indonesian foreign legions as the largest part of the force. You know, perhaps we could even be portraying Indonesians.
That's right.
So how many events do you guys have under your belt now? I know you're a relatively new group, but you've been around, I guess, over a year now, right?
Yeah, so we just celebrated our 1 year anniversary at Newville. Typically, to kind of manage, so I've noticed that the times have changed a little bit when it comes to reenacting, and we've talked about this a few times in the past. You have like kind of site burnout, event burnout, too many events, too little events, too many people, too little people. There's a whole bunch of variations that can lead to reenactor burnout. So what we try to focus on to kind of maximize our time and kind of maximize our bang for the buck is one event per season or four events per year. And that seems to be going pretty solid so far. So we've done four events and we've just concluded our 1 year anniversary at Newville just 2 weeks ago or a week ago.
That's great. Four events a year, to me at one time, I've probably talked about this ad nauseum on the podcast, but to me at one time, four events per year would have been insane. I was doing like four events in 2 months.
Say. Oh, same. I mean, if it was less than one reenactment a month, it would be a slow month.
And right. And now, of course, there are events, but like you say, things are different in many different ways. And I don't know if I'll wind up doing any more than four events this year. What's your strategy for how to keep people interested and engaged and maybe have projects to work on during the time in between those events?
That's actually something that I haven't put much thought into just yet. It seems to be running fairly decently on its own with the group chat. There's just a bunch of history nerds nerding out on history, talking about whatever stream of consciousness debate or new history thing that seems to do pretty well. What I do like to do is I like to create a pretty in-depth event primer, which is like a PDF document that has equipment standards, what unit we're going to portray within the battalion of Grenadier Regiment 41, the historical scenario, basically just to get your head in the game. And then I'll just keep pounding on that and banging the drum for the event. And it's actually turned out pretty well so far.
That's cool. The group chat dynamic is kind of interesting because I think it can be a positive or a negative. It's something that I've kind of struggled with a little bit.
Yeah, it definitely does have to get pared down into, so we have a couple different ones. We have two really, well, three. We have the main one, which is the stream of consciousness. I usually have that one on mute or just no notification so I can catch up on it at will as my life situation allows for it. And then the second one we have is only for announcements. So there's only a select people that can post in that one. And then the third one is the one that we have that's the quote-unquote Gefechtos, and that's for just event coordination / admin details or food or whatever, like projects. So that kind of three-tiered system seems to work out pretty well. I did borrow that from the German unit. So if anybody sees me from Panzerjäger Abteilung 228, please don't get mad. It was a good idea.
Man, sometimes these reenactor group chats, when they have a bunch of people in them who have a bunch of time, not trying to call anybody out here or complain about how people live their lives. I'm in a bunch of group chats. Some are more active, some are less active, but sometimes it's just like, who could possibly have time in a day to read all these messages? And then when you've got so many messages and you can't read them all, it's like, what am I missing? That's kind of what I'm thinking about anyway.
Correct. Yeah. Also for me, it's a kind of a newer phenomenon of people voice recording. So you can't even see what they've written. It's just in the ether and you don't know what it is. And maybe you're in an environment where you can't listen to what they're saying, or it could be something, you know, not acceptable for professional environment. So then you miss out on that as well. So, for me, that the general chats or the friendship chat or whatever you want to call it, the group chat, that stays on pretty much mute until I have time to catch up. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot that gets lost in the ether.
Yeah, totally. Sometimes I think things maybe were a little better when we didn't necessarily have instant access to the personalities of all the people in our reenactment circles, you know?
Yeah, Yes and no, right? Because it does. It's a double-edged sword. It's nice to know that they're always at a fingertip away, right? It's nice to know that any stream of consciousness question can probably be answered from your group, or at least you can get the temperature of the group from that. But it also, again, like you said, it's just too much sometimes. So I enjoy it, but I also don't enjoy it. It pretty much depends on my stress level throughout the day. If it's an easy day and there's not much going on at work or whatever, it's nice to sit around and chat, but most of the time I do not have that amount, so it can get a little bit much, like you said.
Yeah. Going back, I guess, a little bit to some of the communal life stuff that we talked about earlier, I know you try to extend that to other aspects of reenacting as well, like blanks. We talked about some in the past that you don't have people necessarily bringing their own blanks. That's something that's supplied by your group.
That's right. Yep. So, so to standardize things across the group, we do communal food. We do communal hot meals. We do communal rations. We also do communal bread and butter, whatever that comes out with the rations. But we also do communal blanks. And then hopefully in the pretty near future, we'll also have simulated our grenade simulators. So that all comes from the unit dues. We take dues once a year, generally speaking, around the beginning of the end of the calendar year, or beginning, depending on how you want to look at it. And then we'll do a large group purchase of blanks, and you'll be issued your full battle load for every event that you go to. So it's not it is a little bit stressful on some members of the group, especially the ones that are part of the baggage train, to account for and issue and then recover all those things. But I do think that it makes for kind of a not a unique experience, but one that's more akin to military service. You show up with your gear and your warm body, and you get issued everything that you need to survive for the weekend. Your lodging's figured out, your food is figured out, and your ammunition is figured out.
I think there can be sometimes, you've sort of alluded to this, the military simulation aspect of this, the aspect of actually being in the military. I think there sometimes that doesn't get emphasized very much, and I think it's interesting to think about it, because some people, I think, really crave that and really like that. And of course, arguably, that's how it would be, people in the army were in the army. Whereas on the other side of the coin, this is just a hobby, and there is no way to really punish somebody who just tells you, to go away or whatever. How do you try to strike a balance with that?
Yeah, so that's the most difficult thing. I have a pretty solid crew, and they have a good buy-in on these things. We've talked about this through various Zoom meetings or whatever, unit planning meetings, that basically from the duty day, right, from say wake up until 5 o'clock, when after, or 6 o'clock, whatever, whenever after dinner time is, that's business hours, and that's where we will try to attempt the simulation. And that's where somewhat military discipline is enforced. We're not handing out corrective action or anything like that, but I'll be like, hey, I need 2 volunteers to go get the food from the Ausgabe. 2 dudes will raise their hand, and it's usually pretty equitable. To do that, to mitigate that, I guess, the first 2 guys that raise their hands are not getting picked again, and I'll be like, not Eifler, not Bachler, like, who's the next 2? Something like that will usually spread the wealth, and people just see, okay, it's my turn to do the task. But for the most part, it's individual hobbyist buy-in. And another thing is, you kind of have to leverage that balance of being a pretend squad leader and not just an asshole, I guess, to put it plainly. And then also, like, the thing that was brought up in the group, which is interesting, I know you've heard this before from our friend Peter, Dienst is Dienst and Schnaps is Schnaps. So once the Schnaps comes out after the dinner time, that's when things kind of go to more traditional hobby speak and, talk about reproductions or whatever. And if there's something to do at night, then we'll kind of communally come to a decision to do it.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it's kind of a combined approach to first person, but not so much first person that, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you're looking at a burning cigarette by yourself wondering what you're doing. I find that those things can be zony, but it's not for everybody. So we try to do either all or nothing, right? So if one guy's zoning, then nine guys are zoning in the squad, and vice versa. If nobody's zoning, then nobody's zoning. So that way, we kind of get through it together, I guess. Shared hardship seems to be the best way so far, or just sharing experiences.
The all or nothing approach that you mentioned is one that I too have kind of come to in more recent times, despite at one time trying basically to go to events and absolutely be immersed in 1944 from the time that I get my gear on to the time that it's going back in my car. Just in almost all circumstances, that it's just, I just think it's almost impossible for a group of almost any size really to sustain that for the entire duration. You know, there needs to be downtime. And I don't just mean like, you know, not combat time. I mean, time when people can think about just be themselves for a minute and not have to think about how exactly would I respond to this in the reality of some unimaginable historical situation that I read about.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, we share the same experiences from those times. So like even with the most dedicated crew of five or six trying as hard as we possibly could to collectively time travel, there was always, you know, one or two who wouldn't be on board and that would crash to the zone with some modern shaving cream or whatever it was, or just making some sort of joke about social media. So, and that always came with a great amount of disappointment. So the all or nothing approach is really what I found that kind of works so far. And also like, to bring it back to the communal experiences, like a lot of the zone time are things that actually need to get done. So I guess the forcing function kind of is the communal experience, if that makes sense. To elaborate, like when I send the guys to go get food from the Essen Ausgabe, two guys go and they retrieve the food and then they come back and then we eat it, and then I need two guys to clean it out to return it to the Ausgabe. You know what I mean? So like those items in itself are inherently zony, so kind of how we get there doesn't really matter. It's what you're doing that's the zony part. So it kind of, you know, some guy will sit down on his harmonica and play a song while the other dudes are cleaning the Essenträger, and then you have a guy stoking the fire and a guy warming up some food to clean people's mess kits. It kind of works itself out, if that makes sense.
Sure. You talked about so many things that you have done to prepare for the events that you've done, from cooking the meals in advance, bringing the warm food, packaging the cold rations, arranging for the blanks, creating the PDF, all of this work. That's a lot, you know, that's a lot on your plate, I think, as a hobbyist. How are you finding that so far?
Honestly, not bad, because of the, again, one event per quarter seems to limit the burnout on that. Also, I have saved all of my files and all of the, I guess, things that I need to make over and over again in a Google Drive. So that's also shared to the group. So editing something that we've already done to be a new historical concept or a new event primer is easier every year, because it's just editing the already existing shell. So it was a lot of work up front, but it seems to be easier now. The cold rations, that'll always be difficult, right? Because you have to make whatever it is, like I think there's 8 components or 9 components in the German supplementary ration, so that's always a pain in the ass. That's never going away. But to cook two large meals and then freeze them and to put them in the freezer, that's really not that taxing. So it's not too bad. It's a lot of work up front, but once it's all kind of established into a system, it works out pretty easy. It's not that, you know, it's not that difficult to put the ammo cans, you know, into my truck to go to the event. And also it's something that I help, or another, I guess, somewhat zony activity is having the guys from my group put the blanks on stripper clips or load the blanks into belts and make sure that they're lubricated, do our normal maintenance tasks, like things like that, kind of adds to the zone in downtime, and also it helps the unit as a whole.
That's cool. I know something else we had talked about that you had done, you know, sort of as you've been scaling up and getting this thing off the ground, is coordinating some group buys so that members can have the same equipment, maybe get it at the same time, maybe get a discount on it. What's your experience with doing that kind of stuff?
So far it's been positive, although it's been just like anything else with the hobby, and especially hobbyist makers. It's been taxing. So we've done Three group orders so far. We've done one for Sumftarn from Panther Store in the Czech Republic, and we've done an order for Tornisters from Zela 39 in Armenia, and then we've also done a group order of Barrack stools from a local woodworker. That one was a little bit not successful so far. He's still working out the kinks on them, but the other two were fine. It just required a lot of bandwidth of following up, and stuff like that. It's kind of normal, par for the course when you're dealing with these hobbyist bespoke makers, but the results are nice, right? We have everybody in the group has a Tornister, so that's cool. That's like the standard issue army backpack, which I think is vastly underrepresented in the group or in reenacting. And also, when we go to events, everybody has at least some sort of Sumftarn. And I actually like the fact that we have different variations of Sumftarn. So some of the guys in the group have SM Wholesale from a previous run. Some guys have At the Front. Some guys have a previous run of Panther, which looks a little bit more orange, and then some guys have the newer one, which is a little bit more tan and green. So it's a nice, almost, I don't know, again, like a forcing function. It kind of looks real because there's variations of the exact same kit on 9 different people in the squad.
You mentioned the Sumftarn thing being a way to sort of dial into a late war portrayal. What was it about that that really kind of jumped out at you and made you want to incorporate that into your unit look?
So for me, the hooded smocks, so there's like some German newsreel footage from the late war Oderfront, I think it is, where it's Kriegsmarine infantry, and some of them are wearing Sumftarn smocks, some of them are wearing some other padded stuff, but I think the hooded Sumftarn smock is really iconic for the end is near kind of look, and it also is just, it's a completely different vibe from, just being in it. Like, I've noticed times when we're in Feldgrau, it kind of, it feels normal, and then when everybody's wearing the Sumftarn and the weather's kind of shitty outside, it kind of gives you more of a, I don't know if you know the word, like more of an anxious or hectic feeling. It's like a change in the attitude of the group, so I kind of like how that works. It works for both aesthetic purposes and also for the historical reality.
Yeah, and for a mindset purpose too, I can see that. Making sort of a way to distinguish visually when you look around, and it's like a constant reminder that this isn't like, the previous scenario. This is something different.
Correct. Yeah. It looks vastly different. It also feels vastly different. When you're wearing the Sumftarn and the visor hat, as opposed to the traditional and more stylish side cap, it's a different feel. And it's also a very different aesthetic, and people just, quite frankly, look different, right? We look like camouflage swamp monsters instead of, superheroes or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It was interesting. So, like, at the most recent Newville, when it was time to get to getting, it was, like, raining in sheets, and it was, I think it was in the low 40s. It was 44, 45 degrees outside or something like that. So it was like primo hypothermia weather, and I made the decision everybody's gonna put their hoods on over the helmets, and then once they climbed into the muddy trenches, and I could just see like muddy trenches and Sumftarn over the visors of the helmets, I was like, Jesus, like, we look miserable, but also like, this is probably what it probably looked like. You know what I mean?
I love that feeling.
Yeah, just like miserable dudes trying not to freeze to death in the rain. Like, that's
that feeling I don't like as much, but no.
We were very fortunate to have a nice and cozy bunker with some wood stove going. But yeah, doing that for an extended period of time, honestly, that was my biggest takeaway from the event, is that the living history aspect of it is that like Wehrmacht field gear and uniforms are not really they're not made to dry out quickly. So if you were stuck on the line and you had nowhere to go, which most of those men had, you're kind of screwed, right? You have a wet blanket. That's what you have. You don't have a sleeping bag. You don't have a structure. Like, you have a wet wool blanket and probably somebody else's body heat to borrow. So it was kind of sobering that, like I said, I think it went to 38 that night. So that's like the maximum, that's like hypothermia. That's like the ideal conditions for hypothermia. So I imagine, especially with malnutrition and being overworked, like a lot of those dudes probably simply got sick and died. So that was kind of a sobering aspect of that reenactment.
What's the next reenactment you guys are doing?
So that is in, that's actually in the workings right now. We have a couple of different options. I think what we're leaning towards is a training event where we will, kind of conduct our own thing and do some live fire and some squad drill to make sure that we are ready for the next season.
Sounds great.
Yeah. I like to, kind of give the guys the opportunity, or I will like to, I haven't done this in quite a while since our days together. Give the guys the opportunity to kind of experience marksmanship from a World War II perspective, print out the German targets, the big ring targets, put them out at distance and see A, how good of a marksman they are, or B, how not good of a marksman they are. I think a lot of reenactors would be surprised how, if you take a standing shot at someone from 200 yards, 99% of the time you're not hitting what you're aiming at. So just getting them into the mindset of what marksmanship actually might look like from combat stances, and then also doing some squad movements and hand and arm signals and whistles and stuff like that to get us ready for a little sharper for the next reenactment season. I think that'll be both useful and fun.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Sandpaper and steel wool, Scotch-Brite can be your friend. Don't use that stuff in the metal of your live firearm. But on a Denix, that would be the route I take. Beat it up a little bit, but don't make it look like something that survived an apocalypse.
We don't actually get that many negative interactions, which I find very interesting. I don't know if that's the way we approach people or our way of answering questions. And rather than being flustered if we get a difficult question, you know, we talk about things head on.
It's very weird in Germany because there are whole news channels which bombard you with documentaries about Hitler's super weapons and Speer and the whole history, and it's a big topic in Germany. But when you interest yourself in the military aspect, you get pushed into very weird corners.
The Reenactor's Corner, bringing history to life.
Marcus, we are going to run out of time. If someone is interested in learning more about your reenactment group, where should they look?
So we have a Facebook page. We have it's 10th Company Grenadier Regiment 41 on Facebook. That's really the only place right now. The Gmail that we have connected to that is linked in the Facebook, but that's really the one point of where you can contact us.
Cool. Thanks so much for coming on today. It's been fun talking to you, and good luck with that training event. That sounds really cool.
Thank you so much. It was fun to be here.
Okay, so before I go, I just want to say a thank you to everyone who supports the podcast via Patreon. We wouldn't be able to do it without your help. And to Marcus and everybody else, I will see you in the field.
See you in the field.
We love hearing what you think about the podcast, so why not reach out to us on Facebook or Discord? Just search for The Reenactor's Corner and you'll find us there. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting us via Patreon. Your generous contributions, no matter how big or small, really do keep us on the air, and you'll also get regular additional exclusive episodes as a thank you. You can find details of where to find us on Patreon in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time here on The Reenactor's Corner.